cause number 13-78-CV, the Port of Corpus Christi LP versus the Port of Corpus Christi Authority of Nueces County, as well as cause number 19-304-CV, the Port of Corpus Christi LP and 361 Holdings LLC versus the Port of Corpus Christi Authority of Nueces County. Mr. Brooks, whenever you're ready to proceed, you can proceed with argument.
Your Honor, thank you so much. And again, it's just an honor to be here as a part of this historic event. It's historic on a number of levels, but one of them is going to be the fact that the court's going to be interpreting the article or chapter 2267, the so-called Public-Private Partnership Act, as a matter of first impression in the state of Texas. And I think that's going to be very important in the days to come as the private industry and the government partner together. Government can't cede its governmental powers to private individuals. The statutes are in place to protect the citizens in those events. And so this is going to be a case of first impression on that subject. And so it's a first on many levels. As the now, I sent some demonstratives to the filed them and sent them to everyone. And I'm trusting that the court has those because I'll be referring to them. And I'm going to be using them as a background here, essentially to try to orient ourselves. And my staff tells me it's cleaner and easier in a speaker view versus it's small like this. But this is just to get everybody oriented. It's in the Nueces case, which is the first case, you're going to have what's called Harbor Island, and then you're going to have another island called Berry Island. And then you're going to have, if you can see it, a red line here, which is an easement. Now, those are going to be the primary issues in the Nueces case. Now, this is the Corpus Christi Ship Channel where dredging takes place. And the dredging material that comes out is called a dredge spoil, statutorily defined as a waste. And that is taken to dredge material placement areas, such as the Good Hope dredge material placement area, which is part of the San Patricio case. That's this plot of land right there. The purple is the so-called Exxon tract, also in the San Patricio case, which is owned by the appellants. And it's named after their former owner, Exxon. But those are the two primary cases, the Nueces and the San Patricio case, and what they involve. And then you're also going to be seeing and hearing, this is the city of Port Aransas for orientation. And we're going to be mentioning a third case that's not being argued today, but we believe that this court ought to take judicial notice of that case before this very court, the 13th court, where the Port Authority is taking inconsistent positions with those they're taking, we contend, in these cases. So you've got the Nueces and the San Patricio cases, different parties, as you said, Ms. Benavides, different facts, different causes of action and legal principles, but most importantly, or very importantly, the party's alignment is different, because in the Nueces case, the port is the plaintiff versus the defendant in the San Patricio case, and that brings with it certain attendant waivers that come with that. And for sake of brevity, I just
why do you think going. Why do you believe it matters whether they're the plaintiff or counter plaintiff really in the Nueces County case, if the issue before the court is a plea to the jurisdiction? Because I think we've all agreed that the port has sovereign immunity, and so the issue before the court is whether the trial court, whether it was the trial court in Aransas Pass or the trial court in Nueces County, properly granted the dismissal under a jurisdiction matter. So what does it matter whether you're the plaintiff or the counter plaintiff in those matters?
Well, in the Nueces case, where the port initiated it, that implicates what we call the Riata exemption, Riata abrogation, where the Supreme Court in Riata and this very court itself has essentially, in many cases, has said that when the governmental entity avails itself of the court system, it is a waiver for any and all claims and causes of action that the governmental agency has asserted that arise out of, or germane to, or connected with, or properly defensive of the claims that the government has asserted. So that opens up the door as an exemption.
I understand that.
Okay, and that's why it's relevant, the status of the Port Authority as the plaintiff.
So how do the counterclaims that in the Nueces County claim arise out of the original infringement that the port filed in Nueces County. How is that the same so that it falls under the RIADA exception?
Well, it's that you've asked a pivotal question, because the case that has been filed by the Port Authority seeks not only injunctive relief, but $1 million in competitive damages. And that is a position that the Port Authority has claimed scores of times, that they are competitors with my clients, the appellants, and the nature of the competition is what defines the controversy for service mark infringement and dilution claims, because one must get into the court, will be required to get into issues of what is the competitive market, what are the competitive services, who are the customers, what are the damages that are associated with or alleged impact of the service mark claims and dilution claims. So the nature of the competition between our two clients is front and center to the service mark infringement and dilution claims that the government is arguing they have a right to do some sort of an assumed name like some company does, but the elements of their case are going to require everyone to discuss the competitive markets. For example, Omni Corporation, where you can have a company that owns hotels and you can have Omni Corporation that owns pipelines, but they're not competitive and both can use that name. The controversy focuses on the nature of the competition, and we argue here that our clients, the appellants, presented these ideas, the very ideas for an inter-harbor island interconnect to the port as a requirement by the port imposed on us to get this easement that we've talked about. This easement that was critical to the success of the project was required, an easement that the Port Authority routinely gives, required only that we had to come sit down with them and make a full disclosure of all our confidential plans. We did. We disclosed everything to them with express understandings of confidentiality. We had previously, as we say in our pleading, we actually had a right to purchase this Harbor Island property itself. We intended to use it for our Harbor Interconnect, and that wasn't successful. We resorted to a Berry Island. So we disclosed these confidential plans that they have now used, we allege. They have now denied us, not just denied us the easements, which violates our equal protection rights and also implicates inverse condemnation under the Cameron County case that this court recently decided. But it also, they have even denied us hearings on these easements, all for competitive reasons. So this implicates our claims from a standpoint of our rights to purchase the property, our rights to keep our information confidential, our rights to easements that were denied to us. And the port doesn't deny they're doing this out of a competitive drive. They've basically admitted it, and they basically say that it's reasonable for the governmental agency to compete and to not help a competitor. And so they're not denying they're doing this to us, but it is purely.
Well, let me ask you a question. So just to get some clarification, in the Nueces case, are you alleging that there is a contract that falls within Chapter 271 of the local government code, or are you relying solely on RIADA with respect to this claim?
The contract, we're relying on RIADA. We do have a written document that we contend constitutes the contract, but we're relying primarily in this argument on RIADA to allow us to make that argument, and because again we have immunity from suit and immunity from liability, and RIADA could not be clearer that immunity from suit, which is what we're talking about here, is what has been opened up by, in the Nueces case, the Port Authority filing the case first. And as this court, in fact, Judge Benavides, I believe you wrote the Intag opinion in which you said, look, in RIADA, we don't have to prove anything. All we have to do is raise a fact issue, which we have more than adequately done. We had in the Nueces case, in many cases, uncontroverted testimony of an expert who gave multiple declarations about all of the various deals and facets of our arrangement, testifying, for example, that about the rights that were deprived us. But she also talked about TOMA, and that is the Open Meetings Act is a separate from RIADA. That's a separate exemption and a waiver of governmental immunity. Any interested person has the ability to bring a claim under TOMA. Any interested person has standing to bring that, and that's what we've done secondarily and separate and apart from the RIADA claims. And our expert opined on that. She, for example, opined. She went through and analyzed in excruciating detail all of the agendas and minutes of the Port Authority. And she said that from the beginning of time till October 25th of 2018, there was not one single reference in minutes or agendas about this Harbor Island project. And then all of a sudden, what shows up in the minutes on October the 25th is a what I call a secret invocation of the secrecy provisions of 551072, which is what the port invoked to be able to discuss, and they could only do so by statute, to discuss leasing the property. And they could keep it in an executive session if it would be conducted in public, the counterparty with whom they were negotiating would be, they would be prejudiced in their negotiations. Our experts said neither of those occurred. This wasn't about a lease, and it certainly wasn't about something where Carlisle, the counterparty, was the person from whom the port was trying to get protection. Rather, this was to try to keep protection from our clients. Now, what we know...
Counsel, let me ask you a question. I looked through the record. I could not find the lease. It doesn't appear to me that the alleged lease the opposing party is saying they're relying on, that it was a lease. How is it that we're going to be able to look at this and interpret, was it a lease or was it a public, guess what's the other, what you're contending, that it is a public partnership, I guess, partnership versus a lease. You're saying that it's not a lease, but how are we able to interpret this since the lease is not part of the record?
Well, the lease is not part of the record, and you've asked the exact question what we've been asking. The lease was briefly given to the judge. We didn't even realize at the time of the hearing on this, and he gave it back. We filed motions requiring the court to give it back as a court record. The court said, I didn't even look at it. That's what's in the record. And statements that the appellees have made that the court examined it, that's not true. Record references we cite clearly show where the court says, I didn't even barely look at it, and he gave it back. We asked that it be returned. He wouldn't do it. There's nothing we know of to make them bring this to this court, but you're right. All you can do is rely on circumstantial evidence, which is perfectly appropriate at this stage, to infer that it is not a lease, but you can't make the definitive judgment without it being in front of you. But I will tell you one of the circumstances that the court can rely on to know that it isn't a lease. Certainly at this preliminary stage where all you're deciding is whether we've created a fact issue. You have the sealed memorandum of understanding that was falsely referred to in these minutes in October of 2018 as a memorandum to discuss a lease. You have it sealed. Now, I've given it to you a relevant excerpt as a demonstrative here, and I believe it is demonstrative. If you could just look at, demonstrative R, and I can't put it up because it's an excerpt from a sealed document, but this is the memorandum of understanding, so-called, that the court secretly was negotiating an executive session in violation of COMPA, and you can see it negotiates a commercial arrangement where Carlisle, or later called Lone Star Port, is going to be arranging for the construction, operation, finance, development, marketing, in all aspects, pipeline interconnects of a pipeline interconnected terminal. These are our ideas that were taken from the appellants, we allege. The word lease is only used one time in the whole document, and I've highlighted it here. And it is only used in the context, not for leasing property, but about revenues that the Corpus Christi Port of Authority is going to get from the operations. If you will look at demonstrative S, again, we're talking circumstantially while we know this is not a lease, even though that might even have, whether it has the name lease on it or not, we don't know. But it can't be a lease because the memorandum of understanding, falsely described as a discussion only about leases, contemplates the execution of a definitive agreement memorializing these terms in this MOU, so-called, with terms, covenants, conditions, warranties, and representations that are customary or appropriate in transactions of this nature. This has nothing to do with the lease. So circumstantially, not only do you not have the instrument because the Port Authority doesn't want you to have it, the public doesn't have it, has never seen it, and the memorandum of understanding that was supposedly the template or the term sheet by which this so-called lease was signed contemplates a definitive document for construction, management, operation, marketing, financing of a vast project that the port has publicly announced in press releases, but it just won't give a copy to you or me or the public. Now, that implicates, Your Honor, and I want to mention this because it's relevant. We can overlook it. This is a sovereign immunity question. We don't have to prove anything, and that was one of the problems in the lower courts. The appellees would confuse these trial judges with phrases like, you know, the plan. And I got one here from their brief in this court that I just thought was astounding because this is what they told the trial court. They say, this is in their opening brief at page 1 and 2 in this court. They say, appellants rely largely on their unsupported pleadings and conclusory expert testimony to argue that the Port Authority intended to damage their property. This meager showing cannot overcome the Port Authority's affirmative evidence proving it did not allegedly intend to contaminate the property. Well, that right there epitomizes the very arguments they made in the lower court. All we had to do was allege jurisdictional facts. And it was, we don't have to prove or substantiate anything. Jurisdictional facts are alleged or they're not. If they're not alleged, we have a right to amend. Now, if they come forward with disproving a jurisdictional fact, basically providing evidence in the form of affidavits that disproves a jurisdictional act, then we have the burden of moving forward. And in which case this court, like the trial courts, look at this as a traditional motion for summary judgment. You don't weigh the evidence. You say, has the appellate put on a scintilla of evidence? Well, we put on 2 experts. We didn't have to even do that because their affidavits, we don't believe, rose. We think our pleadings were fine. Their affidavits did not identify specific facts that were deficient. And they did not irrefutably establish their entitlement to judgment as a matter of law, but we nevertheless, out of a matter of caution, we gave expert testimony. We didn't have to go that far. Testimony in the Nueces case of a wonderful expert, Jennifer Riggs, a municipal law expert, who analyzed all the details. And in the San Patricio case, an engineer named Wade Wheatley, formerly in the Navy, and he worked with the TCEQ, he analyzed water movements.
So, Mr. Brooks, let's talk about a little bit about the San Patricio case and the affidavit that the port put forward that for at least 30 years, this has been ongoing on at the Good Hope that has always been used as a DMAP before by the Navy and then when the Port Authority purchased it in 2008. And there is nothing to indicate the contamination that the expert put forward or knowledge to the extent that it waives sovereign immunity, the knowledge requirement that raises that then waives sovereign immunity. Well, how do we get the waiver of jurisdictional fact, disputed or not disputed, that the port waived their sovereign immunity under prior knowledge?
Well, that's the key. You say disputed. If it's disputed, as you wrote in the intake case, if it's disputed, it's a fact issue.
I didn't see anything from your expert regarding knowledge that the port had, first of all, that there is any contamination occurring, and second, that the port knew about that contamination, and then continued to do it.
Well, the expert, Mr. Wheatley, testified, and I want to talk about what the port's employee testified, what Mr. Wheatley did, because those, I think, of course, I got to clarify that. But Mr. Wheatley testified that the Good Hope facility, that the dredge material placement area, it looks like this. This is an example. And it was designed specifically, according to Mr. Wheatley's testimony, it was specifically designed to allow wastewater, not a retention pond. Water goes down and into the water table, right, and migrates. And he testified, this is how it was intended and designed to work. Now, Mr. Wheatley says that when vast quantities are coming in, wastewater, which is a statutory waste, comes over this weir. You can see it actually, the weir actually, is, there's a drain right there, and that water seeps over and goes out into the adjoining property. So our property has been contaminated both on the surface by overflow on the weir and underneath, as this project was intentionally designed to work. Now the intent from the design is exactly what we believe is brings us into the purview of the cases that we cited in our reply brief. The cases of the Bernie case and the Grad case and the...
But it's always... The port didn't do anything with this design. That design has always existed. It's existed for years. And when the LLP purchased the property next to it, it already existed in the design that it existed.
That is an argument that was never made in the trial court, never made in this case until their opening brief. That is new evidence and a new argument they did not make. They produced the declaration of two people, Sean Strawbridge and David Krams, and he basically does say that we got it from the Navy. But that's it. He doesn't talk about the design. In fact, to the contrary, he talks about his reviewing of the plans, and he said that I was not in his. It is an affidavit that does not move the ball down the court in terms of putting a burden on us. But he simply says that I was never told that it didn't, that contamination was occurring. I didn't know, and none of my employees told me that. That's not institutional knowledge that says it isn't occurring. He says he reviewed the plans. He says that we required drawings and permits. I'm looking now at paragraph, I believe it's 5, where he says we followed our standard procedures. We looked for permitting processes for dredge replacement materials, and we looked at the sediment. He doesn't say anything about TCEQ requirements. And then in paragraph 6, at the time of the 4 dredges, I believe that the dredge material posed no threat of contamination. He doesn't say it wasn't our fault or the Navy did it and it wasn't us. He said, I to the contrary. He assumes responsibility. He just says, I didn't know, but that doesn't mean that the port doesn't know. And it doesn't mean that when they're looking at the plans, as he references in paragraph 5, it doesn't say that he's looking at the plan. Why would he look at the plans? Why is he looking at them? Why is he trying to examine them if he doesn't have responsibility for its design?
So, but counsel, when they stated in these affidavits, we have no knowledge, we did not do this intentionally, then wouldn't it have been incumbent upon your expert to find some evidence that they did have some knowledge? I mean, I don't recall exactly the case that's cited in the briefs, but there's even a case that was more egregious where the person that was being contaminated by the entity actually had a memo where there was knowledge that it was some sort of, I don't recall, it was some sort of nuisance, I think regarding a stench or something that the municipality was doing affecting the adjoining property. And in that case, the courts found that wasn't enough. So, I mean, here they very specifically stated, we did not know that we were in any way affecting or creating this destruction or damage to the adjoining property. And then that's where it stands. There's nothing in the record that I could find where you were able to anyway counterbalance that type of statement.
Mr. Brooks, answer Justice Hinojosa's and your time is up.
Okay. Well, first of all, there's two affidavits, and neither of them say what I believe the court believes. The case is Mr. Strawbridge simply says, I believed the placement of, this is paragraph 5, posed no threat of contamination. That's it. The only thing that even arguably addresses this is Mr. Krams, and we've said before that can't be a statement for the entity. But the cases that you're referring to, Your Honor, the cases that are in the briefing are cases that deal with the difference between inaction and action. You could do something, but the government chose not to. Not they don't turn on knowledge of one individual. And I can get the court as a supplement. I'll show you the places where Mr. Wheatley testifies very specifically about this. But more importantly, it's a fact issue. And their evidence does not disclaim institutional knowledge. And we were deprived of the ability to take discovery in both cases in violation of the Hartz-Bluff mandate that requires that.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. No problem. Mrs. Stokes, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. Wait for my time to start. May it please the court. There is one commonality among the many claims that TPCC has asserted against the board in these two lawsuits, and that is that TPCC did not carry its burden to plead or prove a claim within a recognized waiver of or exception to the immunity of the court, its commissioners, and its CEO. Now, there are so many claims that some in these cases that it's hard to keep them straight, but I think we can divide them into jurisdictional categories in each case and walk through the trial court's reasons for dismissing each category of claim. And with the court's permission, I'll turn to Good Hope first, since it's a more discreet case, and Mr. Brooks ended with that. This one only involves two claims: inverse condemnation against the Port Authority and an ultra-virus claim against our CEO, Mr. Strawbridge. Now,
did you agree, Ms. Stokes, that an inverse condemnation case does waive sovereign immunity?
I do believe that if you state a viable takings or inverse condemnation claim that is non-negligent nuisance, that it can be an exception to immunity.
So your key word there was viable, and that's where I believe that the crux of this case occurs, is how much does this court, along with the trial court, had to find it to be viable, go beyond the pleadings? Because that's, I think, what Mr. Brooks is arguing, that we are making a determination of almost a question of law and a summary judgment in order to decide a jurisdictional issue, as to just taking the facts, as he says, to be true, whether they are not enough or disputed facts, in order to ascertain, well, then we have an adverse compensation or a takings case, and as such, sovereign immunity is waived.
Yes, Your Honor. We applying the Supreme Court's framework for immunity, we did challenge the jurisdictional facts as to this inverse condemnation claim. We did challenge it with evidence. And the Supreme Court has said when you do that, it is akin to a summary judgment standard. And we need to present evidence that establishes that there is no claim, and then it shifts the burden to TPCC to at least raise a fact issue. Now here, we moved and presented evidence that there was no intent to harm, which the Supreme Court has said is an essential element of any inverse condemnation claim. And as Justice Hinojosa pointed out, we had affidavit testimony from the Director of Engineering, who oversaw the Good Hope DMPA, and we had testimony from our CEO that they had no awareness of any migration subsurface of pollutants to the Exxon track. And the Supreme Court has said it needs to be knowledge of harm to a particular property, a property interest. And that was sufficient to shift the burden. I mean, you do need knowledge and intent proven for an entity, and how else to prove it for an entity but the officials that run the company. The city of San Antonio versus Pollock case that Judge Hinojosa cited involved much stronger facts of knowledge, as the justice pointed out. They knew there was some migration. They knew that the gas, the methane, it was carrying benzene underground. And we don't have any evidence of that. The only evidence they pointed to, as Mr. Brooks points out, was Mr. Wheatley's testimony. But Mr. Wheatley said nothing about our knowledge. He talked about the design of the Good Hope DMPA, which we pointed out at the hearing that was not waived. We pointed that out. And in fact, that testimony came from their own expert, Wheatley. He said that the Navy designed the DMPA, and there's evidence of that, and that it had not been modified since that time. And he said that the design of it was intended to and substantially certain to cause harm. But he never, ever even alleged that we had any knowledge that design was substantially certain to harm Exxon track, let alone anyone. And the Supreme Court has said that's key. It's got it. It's not just that the design is out there, it's that we knew that this was substantially certain to happen. We also did move on another essential element that the court has said in the Harris County Flood Control District versus Kerr case is another essential element of takings. We said that we negated the proximate causation of harm. There were some vague allegations in the pleading of migration of subsurface contaminants to the Exxon tract. But we pointed out that Mr. Berry himself, the owner of TPCC, affirmatively testified that his remediation of the Exxon tract, which is why he has a lease interest in that tract to remediate it, that that is on track and going full steam ahead, and that his own DMPA, the Berry Island DMPA, is sold out and at capacity for the next 2 years. So there was affirmative evidence that there was no economic impact to the to TPCC, and in addition, both Mr. Berry and Mr. Wheatley conceded that there were no scientific analysis or data that showed any harm to the Exxon tract from the Good Hope DMPA. Now, the other claim—
Ms. Stokes, could there be inference facts as to the knowledge? We always know that trying to get direct evidence of, in this case, any defendant of some type of intent to harm is always difficult. So I can't remember what case I read where they talked about inference of it or circumstantial evidence. Is the testimony sufficient of Mr. Whitley to say, well, the port, based on the design, had to have knowledge of the contamination to adjacent properties because of the overflow?
No, Your Honor, there is no such testimony either in his affidavit or at the hearing. He did not allege that, he didn't say anything about what we knew about the design. He constantly focused on the nature of the design. He didn't go to that second step to say, you know, and it was, you know, that they had to have known about it and why that would be true. So we just don't have that evidence in this case.
Counsel, sure. I guess the arguments, I guess, are a lot more complex, and there are a lot more options for us to find in favor or of denying, I guess, or remanding the case and changing the outcome of the lower court in the other case. I find the Nueces case, I guess, more compelling. In particular, the issue of the lease. You all are asking us to interpret it as a lease, that there was no P3 agreement, and yet there is no lease in the record. So how are we to make a determination that, you know, don't we need to review the terms of the purported lease agreement to really decide that you all did not violate TOMA? Don't we need to look at that to see that it in fact was correctly posted and that there was adequate notice? If in fact it's not really a lease, it really is a P3 agreement.
So, Your Honor, go ahead. I have several responses to that, and a couple of threshold ones. The violation of the P3 agreement doesn't state a claim against the Port Authority because there's no private right of action or waiver of immunity in the P3 Act. As to TOMA, there obviously is a waiver of immunity, but we do, we argued in our brief that even, let's assume it's a P3 agreement, that we still gave adequate notice, that if the court looks at the meeting notices and the Lone Star memo that was attached to it, we gave a lot of detail. We told them the when, where, why, and who. We said that, told the public that we were leasing 200 acres of Harbor Island to a specific entity, and even detailed their constituent members for 50 years for the purpose of a crude oil export terminal that could accommodate very large crude carriers. And we even went into detail about our anticipated lease income from this. And there's no law, no cases we have found that have said that kind of detail is not sufficient just because you didn't give the legal classification, a correct legal classification of the agreement or what statute it falls under. And on the contrary, the cases have been like Cox Enterprises, where the court found a violation of the notice requirements because there was a one word personnel, and they said that doesn't tell the public that this is about some very important desegregation litigation against the district. So I would submit that it's still sufficient, but let's move on to the lease. Do you need the evidence if you don't agree with us on that? No, you don't need the lease and evidence, and there's several reasons why. One, there was other evidence in the record of what the material terms of the lease, that Lone Star memo and the minutes of the open meetings. And not only did TPCC not object to this evidence on either the best evidence rule or any other basis, but they affirmatively relied on it. And their expert opined that those things were sufficient for her to determine the nature of the agreement and for her to opine that it was a P3 agreement. Now, obviously we disagree with her on the conclusion she reached, but at the time there was no dispute that she had what she needed to determine the material terms of this very confidential lease that the Attorney General has said should not be publicly available. And I think on this record, they cannot show a clear abuse of discretion, which would be their burden, and the trial court's refusal to order us to produce the lease, particularly because when they moved to continue the hearing on our plea to the jurisdiction on an alleged need for discovery, at the same time, they wanted the court to go forward that same day with the hearing on their motion for partial summary judgment on the P3 Act claim. And they told the court that they had conclusive evidence that the lease was really not a lease, it was a P3 agreement, and so they ought to get a partial summary judgment. So I don't think they can be heard to complain about that on appeal now. And I've got even a fourth reason, Your Honor, if you want to hear it, that I think the vast majority of the claims, the dismissal would have to be upheld regardless of whether the lease is a P3 agreement or not. I pointed out the P3 Act violation claim against the port. I pointed out TOMA, but also there's other claims that don't fall within a statutory waiver or exception, no matter what facts you could ever plead, like the water code violations, the Open Record Acts violations, the declaratory judgment, the business disparagement.
But going back to where we started the argument with Mr. Brooks, since you sued his client first and then he countersued, isn't this under Ariadna in that they're arising out of it so that the port can't say we can sue you, but you can't countersue us, putting people at, so you waived your sovereign immunity by bringing the lawsuit because these all arise and doesn't allow the appellee in this case to bring the actions that they need to bring to defend themselves in the claim that your client brought.
Yes, Your Honor, that the Ariadna exception is a judicially created exception, but the Supreme Court has said it's very narrow, and I don't think they've met their burden. And clear, it's a burden on the pleadings. The courts don't get into the merits of the claim. They don't get into the evidence. And in fact, in Nazari versus State, the court said, we are not going to look at the merits. We are not going to see whose competing version of the facts is correct to decide Ariadna, whether the exception applies. But it's got to be both offsetting and it's not arising out of, as Mr. Brooks said, it's germane to, connected with, and properly defensive to. And that's a heavy lift. Just to move straight to since that's the one he mainly addresses, the germane to, that has been extremely narrowly construed. In Umel Oil, which the court approved of in Nazari, the Supreme Court said, even when the state sues to recover unpaid taxes for 1 month, your counterclaim for overpaid taxes, the exact same taxes, but just in a different month, those aren't germane to or connected with. And this court itself in the TxDOT versus Crockett case that Mr. Brooks has in his demonstrative, they found that the standard was not met. And that's a situation where TxDOT was suing for conversion. It had accidentally paid money under a landscaping services contract to the defendant, and the defendant wouldn't give it back. It really owed it to a different party. And then the defendant counterclaimed and said, well, you owe me some money on other landscaping contracts, and so these relate. And the court said, no, these claims arise from distinct conduct at different times and under very different circumstances, and they require proof of different elements. And importantly, this court rejected an attempt to take such a 1,000-foot view of the Ariadna germane to requirement that the mere fact that both were claims involving landscaping services to TxDOT was enough to satisfy Ariadna. And here we have a service mark infringement. It said that you've been using our name, the Port of Corpus Christi, that we have an exclusive right to in your own business. And then now they want to come in and say, well, even though we're not complaining about that, you've raised what the competitive market for port services is, and that necessarily includes Harbor Island and everything else. And so then we can talk about any conduct we want related to to the port. And that's simply not how it works. And if it did, I think Riotto would swallow the rule of immunity.
Well, counsel, they've sort of come up with, I believe I counted 7 basis for Riotto, causes of action. They have like 7 causes of action, I guess. How about business disparagement? Could that one conceivably be tied directly to your original suit, whereby taking it out of our, you know, jurisdiction or protection?
Right, Your Honor. We did not particularly challenge the germane two prong as to business disparagement, but the two prongs are mandatory, and the other prong is offsetting. And the Supreme Court has said that's pretty narrow. In Nazari versus State, they said you can never satisfy the offsetting requirement if it's a winner-take-all situation. If the state wins on its affirmative claim, it's going to get damages and you won't on your counterclaim, or vice versa. And that's exactly what we have here with business disparagement, is that if they win, their suit is basically based on the fact that we are telling people we have the exclusive right to the name and we shouldn't have sued them. And so if we win on our suit that we do have the exclusive right and they can't use it, we're going to get damages, they're not. And vice versa, if they're right that we never should have sued them, then we're not going to get damages. So there's never a situation where there will be damages that they can offset up to the limit of damages we are awarded. And the Supreme Court has said that's what Riotto is all about. Does that answer the court's question?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I believe you cited a case to that effect in your brief. I do recall
Yes. You
responding to it, yes.
Yes, Your Honor. That's right. And then I think we also have that claim about the declaratory judgment that, you know, that we shouldn't be, we don't have the exclusive right to that name. We didn't challenge that on Germanus. We did challenge it on offsetting. And in addition, the fact that that it's a declaratory judgment, and the Supreme Court after Riotto in 2018 and Nazari made very clear that the Riotto exception only applies to claims for damages. So I think that has been settled. Yes, Your Honor.
Counsel, in talking about those press releases, it seems to me, looking at them, that you basically, don't they basically proclaim that it is a P3 with Carlisle, and doesn't that at least create some sort of fact question or a fact issue regarding the nature of the arrangement? And if so, does it matter?
Your Honor, that's a good question, and the answer is no. And the answer is no, based on this court's own precedent. In the City of Corpus Christi versus Bayfront Associates Limited, and that site is 814 Southwest 2nd 98, this court said that very similar out-of-court statements by lay officials, I believe it was a mayor and other city officials, about a contract being a partnership. The court said whether city officials actually referred to Bayfront as the city's partner is not determinative of the legal relationship of whether a partnership existed vel non. We hold that no partnership existed under the terms of the lease. And they said, in other words, a duck which is called a horse does not become a horse. A duck is a duck. And so that was no evidence as to the legal effect of an agreement, these out-of-court statements that were by our CEO and not made in a legal context.
Well, but don't you agree that the MOU really doesn't contemplate a future lease arrangement? Because all of it, I mean, looking at the publicity and everything that was put out by the city and put out by the, I guess, executives of your client, I mean, basically call it a partnership. I mean, it repeatedly in the exhibit that Mr. Brooks gave us this morning or yesterday, I mean, it keeps calling it a partnership. And I don't see anywhere where it talks about a lease. Maybe there's one place, I believe, maybe. But
are you talking about in the press releases, Your Honor?
Yes, in the press and in the MOU.
In the MOU, right.
The MOU. Yes. So, Your Honor, on the MOU point, the MOU is merely an agreement to try to reach a definitive agreement. And when the court looks at it, it says they were contemplating a variety of possible definitive agreements pertaining to a crude oil export terminal that could accommodate very large crude carriers. They did mention lease, but they mentioned a lot of other different possibilities and said, we're gonna work on trying to get there. We made no commitment to enter any particular type of definitive agreement, much less a P3 agreement. And as the case turned out, after these exclusive negotiations, they decided that a lease of property to Lone Star Port so that they could build and operate such a terminal was the right way to go about to facilitate their purposes. And I would stress that the MOU itself expressly says nothing in this MOU is binding except for our agreement to exclusively negotiate with each other for this particular time period. So there's no commitment. I don't think the MOU could be any proof of what the eventual agreement that they reached is. And as I said, I believe we have evidence of what that was, sufficient evidence on the record, that it was a lease and not a P3 agreement.
Well, but don't you think that we're at a disadvantage because we can't see the lease or the purported lease to really make a determination whether the notice of what the action that was going to be taken as provided for in the agenda, whether it was sufficient to give notice to the public in an area that obviously is of interest to the public? Was it sufficient if we are not privy to the lease that was, or the agreement that was eventually entered into? I guess I'm grappling with that.
Yeah,
it's not in the record.
Well, I think we've talked about the reasons why, you know, TPCC would have to show an abuse of discretion in refusing to compel the lease. And I think they cannot do it for the reasons I stated, and we think there is sufficient evidence of the lease. But I think, as we discussed, I think the TOMA notice gave an abundance of details. And I mean, I have not been able to find any case that ever said, even though you gave all those details, which were correct, that mm-hmm. you had to call it a P3 agreement or you had to reference the P3 Act. I've never found a single case like that. And in fact, the evidence showed that the public did understand that notice and did show up to comment and talk about the lease before it was signed by the approved by the commissioners.
Well, but if we decide that the trial court and by extension this court needs to review the terms of the purported lease agreement, can't this court remand the case back for further development of the record?
I mean, of course, the court can make whatever decision it believes is proper, but I don't believe that they have shown an abuse of discretion. I believe that we've met the Miranda standards for proving that TOMA was not violated. And I would stress that a lot of their TOMA violations are about things like deliberating in closed sessions that are not actionable whether you remand to look at the lease or not, because as this court said in Rubalcaba, that if the final vote was taken in open session, then you don't have an actionable TOMA claim.
Yeah, and I don't have a problem with that. The executive session argument doesn't seem to me as persuasive as the notice argument that they're making, that the notice just did not give sufficient information to the public. But I guess you can fall back on the fact that there were people. I guess your position is that the fact that there were people there to argue for and against it is sufficient evidence to show that the notice was adequate.
I think that's right. I think it shows it. Plus the notice itself and the Lone Star memo attached to it, and the fact that we have no case. I've never been able to find a case that required more detail than that. I mean, the cases that get sent back are bare bones notices. And again, I don't think that that in a situation where they rely on evidence in the record to show the nature of the lease, and they say that is conclusive evidence for summary judgment purposes, I don't believe that they can show an abuse of discretion in not having the lease. So I don't think there's a basis for this court to send it back to look at the lease, respectfully. Okay. I guess in the time I have, unless the court has another question, I could talk about the P3 agreement. And that, as I noted, the only way that the P3 Act is even relevant, it's not in the violation asserted against the Port Authority is not actionable. There's no private right of action, no waiver of immunity in the statute. So the only way they can get to that is the ultra-virus claim against the commissioners. But they have not stated an ultra-virus claim because, as a matter of law, the P3 Act does not apply to the lease The Act says that it applies only to qualifying projects, which it defines as facilities being made available to the government entity by a private entity for which the government pays, makes payments, lease payments, service payments, all the payment provisions in that statute, they all involve payments from the governmental entity to the private entity. And our guidelines, which the legislature required us to adopt, are consistent with that. And we say a P3 agreement, that we are adopting the Act only as to agreements by which a private entity makes physical assets or services available to the port in exchange for fixed payments from the port to the private entity. And here, I think it's the evidence in the record shows that it's the opposite situation. We are leasing land to a private entity, and the private entity is paying us, and all the payments are coming to us. And separate and apart from the lease, our CFO, Kent Britton, testified that that the only payments being made are from Lone Star Ports to the port and not vice versa. And I think regardless of the lease, he was qualified and had personal knowledge of the payments being made under that agreement. Now, Mr. Brooks said, well, I think the only thing I wanted to address on this end that I haven't talked about is the City of Port Aransas judicial admission. That's not a judicial admission. That they don't put the pleading in the record, but the snippet they have in, we weren't even talking about the lease. We were arguing that the City of Port Aransas' ordinance, which is no longer in effect, it expired, but we are arguing that it violated or was preempted by the Texas Natural Resources Code's oil and gas operations provision. Again, didn't mention the lease. And the statement that their oil and gas operations on Harbor Island is not inconsistent with a lease, because the lease here, as we've said, was a lease for Lone Star Ports to develop a crude oil terminal, which is obviously oil and gas operations. So there's no disconnect between these cases. There's no judicial admission, and there's certainly no admission that the lease is something other than a lease. Also, as to the ultra-virus claim, I think they can't state a violation on the water codes, various provisions, the procurement provisions, because those don't apply to when the port leases property to others. Those apply when we are making procurements. The provision that does apply is section 60.120 and 62.107 that specifically says that the port may lease its property and doesn't place restrictions on its ability to do so. I think I've hopefully covered everything. Unless the court has further questions, I'll cede the rest of my time.
Anybody further questions? I have none. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your
Honor. Do you have a question, Justice Inhofe?
Well, just the last question is, I guess they also argue that somehow that your client had a contract or was some sort of option that they gave to Mr. Berry's company regarding a kind of first dibs, I guess you would say, if this project was ever going to be promoted by the port. So how would you respond to that?
Sure, Your Honor. I mean, I thought I heard Mr. Brooks say that they weren't relying on the Chapter 271 waiver of immunity as to that. But regardless, we addressed it. That does not state a claim within the statutory waiver because they don't even allege a contract. There's a couple reasons. They don't even allege a contract with TPCC, which is the only party to the Harbor Island Nueces County case. That the letter that they quote was from the port to Mr. Berry at the Berry Company, and there was no mention of TPCC. So I think it doesn't state a breach of contract claim within the waiver, but it also doesn't allege even a definite enforceable promise. The letters in it say that they never promised to sell. They certainly never promised to sell to Mr. Berry. And in fact, they reject his request to do that at the time. And they say, if in the future we ever decide to sell, we will comply with the statutes that would require us to put it out for bidding or what have you. And so I would submit that that doesn't allege a viable claim to say that a mere promise to follow law that already binds you is not a consideration or does not create an enforceable contract. So I think it doesn't fall within that for that reason too.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Anything further? We'll take back to 20 seconds, Mrs. Stokes.
Can I have them?
I'm sure you would take that and more if we gave it to you, Mr. Brooks.
I appreciate it very much, your time, though. May I proceed, Your Honor?
You may start now.
So, and there's so many things that I would like to be able to address. Time won't permit, but I do want to say that our reply briefs in both the SANPAD in this case, and I know the court has read them and will do so again, but we address virtually every argument that they've made, and we refute every single argument. And time does not permit me to go through them, but let me just pick up a couple of them. What was said to you just a moment ago by Ms. Reisner, Ms. Stokes, is that, well, the MOU, she says, was really an agreement to explore the possibility of a terminal. That's not what they told you in this brief, but they told you here and in the trial court and in the minutes of the meetings. It says I'm quoting from their brief. The entire purpose of the MOU was to further discussions in the hopes of executing a lease. That's what they told you. They said, and the uncontroverted evidence shows the Port Authority deliberated leasing Harbor Island in closed session, which is exactly what the notice says. So you know, and again, I don't get into ad hominems here, but that's not what you're being told today, that about characterizations of the MOU is exploring this vast pipeline interconnect. That's not what they said in the notices, and that's not what they said in their briefing, and that's not what they said to the trial court. Now, the point was made that well, did everybody show up at these hearings in March, the public, because your notice was sufficient? Well, we just got through talking about the fact of the public releases. The Port Authority was telling in notices and agendas, which our expert has looked at, and said there's no reference to this labyrinth in the agendas and minutes. Why are we now trying a case based upon argument of counsel? Doesn't that at very least indicate a fact issue? The notice of the meeting, I mean, Ms. Stokes references several things, but the notice of the meeting that we're talking about now in March for the lease itself was, let me see if I can grab this. I apologize, I'm in the wrong time frame. That simply said, we're going to have a hearing or a notice. This is it, approve a lease agreement. Now she's referencing, says, well, yeah, but if you dig into some filings, get down into the weeds, you could find a little more information. That's the agenda that's published. That's it. That's what the public is given. That's not sufficient. Now, she said something else that I find interesting. She says, if I understood her correctly, the MOU, she says, cannot be evidence of the lease. Well, wait a minute. Their argument to you in their papers was that the lease supersedes in its entirety the MOU, intended to replace it. So how can you make, on the one hand, the argument that the lease and the MOU are not related, the MOU is not evidence, when in fact the MOU states that we're negotiating definitive agreements to accomplish these things, and their own filings say that the lease, so-called, is the memorialization and finalization of the MOU. You cannot disassociate these things. You have a pattern and practice of deceptive, dishonest, secretive conduct that's taking place at the Port Authority of Corpus Christi. The citizens of this state, and particularly Nueces County and San Patricio, have a right to have these things published. The P3 statute that is referenced is absolutely accessible to us. We address in our reply briefs that we have standing to assert that under a number of bases. Number one, as an interested party, the cases of LARA, L-A-R-A, and steel importers, Supreme Court cases we cite, they do not address them, specifically say that if you have an interest different from the general public, then you can bring those claims for statutory violations. We've asserted them. We've asserted we wanted to be a bidder on the project. We had a right to purchase the project. We're in competition with them. They're trying to use this PV project to withhold, to stifle competition on many fronts that they've admitted. LARA and steel importers, they don't even address those. Now, we have an absolute right to raise those under TOMA. Now, whether or not, Justice Hinojosa, you're persuaded by the executive session, the Attorney General has nothing to do with the executive session. That's a Freedom of Information Act letter that is being trotted out to this court as if it's some sort of agency attorney general imprimatur that the lease agreement is super secret. This is from a, that's from a Freedom of Information Act, irrelevant to a statutory requirement that you cannot go into executive session. It's a crime. It is a crime to go into executive session. We're not asserting it as a criminal act, but it is a crime to go into executive session when you're not supposed to. And in this case, our expert says there's two different reasons. Number one, they weren't talking about a lease, and you just heard her say it. She admitted it. Really, the MOU was not really about a lease. It was really about a discuss the possibility of a larger project. And secondly, it wasn't. They went into executive session not because of Carlisle, because of us. Now, the other fact that I think is very important to emphasize here is that the press releases that she cites the case again. It's very frustrating, but she cites the Corpus case where after a trial, where the document, the lease so-called, was in front of the court, and the plaintiff, I guess, was trying to say, yeah, but I know what the document says, but they told us something different in our negotiations in the court, applying what would be tantamount to the parole evidence rule, says, well, okay, wait a minute. You can't use parole statements to contradict what your lease agreement says, a lease that you don't have in front of you, as Justice Hinojosa has pointed out several times. That case has nothing to do with whether we've stated a viable claim under the sovereign immunity. But more importantly, they don't address, again, the case that we've cited, the Texas Supreme Court case it's Texas Supreme Court, what's my case? Lubbock case, where a lease was in fact signed and a document was called a lease. But the Supreme Court says, look, just because that's the document's title, that doesn't mean it's a lease. You can put whatever you want to on it. We have to look at the substance. And they say, furthermore, that even though a portion of your document may actually have lease language, and we do not know that it does here, all we have to do, because we haven't seen the document, we have to take their word for it, we don't know what's in there. But even the Supreme Court teaches, if a portion of it deals with a lease, that doesn't mean the whole thing's a lease. You can have a document that contains multiple pieces, multiple concepts. So we have standing. This is a RIADA implication from a, we've raised a fact issue. We've got standing under a variety of statutes. Now I want to, basically the Nazari case is another red herring. She talks about the Nazari. Listen, this court right here, this court in the Redburn case, a case that in 2013 that the court does not cite. They don't even mention it. But in the Redburn case, a fella buys some property. After the fact, he comes in, there's a culvert on his property. He puts a cement plug in a drainage ditch. And the drainage ditch had been there for many, many years. Years later, he puts the plug in, and the government comes in and says, hey, we're going to sue you to force you to remove the plug, and he files a counterclaim. This very court said that is a germane, that is perfectly proper under RIADA, and in the Nazari case, the dissent even cites that case as good law. They acknowledge that the Redburn case cited by the Corpus Court is still good law. And that is squarely on our points right here. I would like to address, if time permitted, the Pollock case. It's irrelevant to this issue. But it's all in our reply briefs, every bit of it. Thank you so much for your time and attention.
Thank you so much. And thank you for some briefs from the court that we can definitely use. And thank you for participating in the first Zoom hearing of the 13th Court of Appeals and for all your time and energy to make sure that this pretty much went without a hitch. I think I had a nightmare last night that we all lost internet and we were all freezing, and that did that not occur is quite excellent. And I want to acknowledge my staff who is on mute, but who is listening, who did a great job of getting everybody on board. And this case will be under submission. Thank you very much for excellent oral arguments this morning. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you.